Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, Kate Gate. What does this latest Photoshop faux pas tell us about media consumers and levels of trust in the media? Also on the programme, the Telegraph Media Group deal is not yet done, as our government intends to legislate to keep the titles out of foreign government hands. So is the race back on? All that, plus we look at how British TV is reacting to AI, why Newsnight could become a podcast, and in the media quiz, we choose our pick of the pot. That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, TikTok has been dealt a blow by the US House of Representatives after it overwhelmingly passed a law to force Chinese owners ByteDance to divest control within 165 days. The company said that the legislation amounts to a total ban of TikTok in the United States. Elon Musk has fired X's new star Don Lemon before the show has even aired one episode. And the reason for the sudden U-turn? Lemon was tasked with interviewing the billionaire, saying his commitment to a global town square where all questions can be asked and all ideas can be shared seems not to include questions of him from people like me. And set your air fryers to 200 degrees. Channel 4 have announced that Jamie Oliver will be hosting a two-parter on the subject that has been a commissioner's dream over the past few months. Oliver has partnered with TfL on this short-run series. And joining me at the London Podcast Studios to cover the other media stories this week, we welcome back Rebecca Cooney, Inside Editor of Broadcast. Hello.
Hello. How's it going?
Very good, thank you. I was looking at some things that you've been writing, and you were at the London TV screenings.
Yes, so I wasn't quite at the London TV screenings. Okay. My colleague John was going to more of the screenings than I was, but sort of doing a lot of the coverage around it. So yeah, we do a hot picks where we ask the distributors to send us the things they think are going to sell the best. And then we kind of pick our favourites, but we also look at what can we tell from the submissions about what is it the distributors think is going to be the big hitting titles.
Yes, what's the trend for the next 12, 18 months then?
It seems to have all got a bit serious, to be honest. So, you know, a couple of years ago, we were sort of talking about sort of previous thing at MIPCOM and Cannes. There was lots of, there was a bit of a more of a move towards comedy, towards kind of, or dramedy, which is a portmanteau that I really hate, but, you know, that sort of comedy drama bent. Whereas this seems to be kind of a lot more in the way of sort of thrillers, in the way of kind of, you know, true crime, that sort of thing, and which obviously true crime is perennially popular, but that's sort of, and it's a theory that I've heard recently that people are looking for escapism either in kind of warm and fluffy or in I'm going to embrace the darker side of life in this way and then not think about how it's happening in the real world, sort of thing. So I think that's kind of what they seem to be thinking.
And next to Rebecca, we have Press Gazette's UK editor, Charlotte Tobit. Hello.
Hi, Matt.
You've been speaking to Jamie East, friend of the show, this week about his landing at the Daily Mail and everything he's been up to with podcasts.
Yeah, sounds quite exciting.
Like, what's he up to?
So literally like this time last year, the Daily Mail was doing the trial of Lucy Letby, this kind of really unusual and unprecedented podcast where they're following the trial of Lucy Letby as it's going on, like every day there's a new podcast. And then Mail didn't really have anything else in place with podcasts, and that worked, and then they hired Jamie last summer, and he's come in. He's basically been given kind of a vision from the owner, Lord Rothermere, of how everything should connect. He's said he was very complimentary to Lord Rothermere, saying like he actually walks the walk on wanting to be a 360-degree company, whereas other companies just say the words. And so, yeah, he's been given like creative freedom, and he's building out a whole audio strategy. They've got, I think, I think it's 4 other podcasts have started since he's joined, and he said they've got 19 in pre-production, so quite a lot to come.
That's a big old slate.
Yeah, I mean, he literally said, like, I can't think of another comparable company doing that number or planning that number. So I think it will be one to watch. And, you know, he does admit that, like, they're not all going to be massive successes, and they won't all be like The Trial of Lucy Letby, which got loads of admiration. But, you know, even if just a few are, then that's pretty good going. So
you've got to plant a lot of seeds, don't you, to for these things to work.
He did say, like, there's no shame in cancelling a podcast if it doesn't work, because I think a lot of people kind of get stuck on it and think it's embarrassing to stop it. But actually, you know, if you think about it, if it's not doing that well, not many people have seen it anyway, so
yes,
it doesn't matter that much. Just try a new thing, or, you know, learn something from that and then move on. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what the Mail and its sister titles comes up with soon.
And also, it's quite interesting, isn't it, the Mail sort of went private again, or sort of reacquired all of the shares from other shareholders. It does give you, if you're the owner of everything, you get to decide, don't you? You get to decide where the money goes. If you're going to invest something into the business, it's easier to make that happen when you don't have to worry about everyone else.
Exactly. I think it means that they can have a longer term vision rather than thinking about the next kind of year's financial results and profit for just that year, and being able to invest and then think, well, in a few years that will really pay off and it'll future proof us. That is just something that would be harder to do if it was still public.
Well, we start today with Kate Gate. Of course we are. The Princess of Wales apologised this week for a photo released by the palace that had been the subject of a kill notice by AP, which sounds very dramatic. Charlotte, what is a kill notice?
So basically, it's when the agencies say this photo doesn't meet our editorial standards, you shouldn't use it, get rid of it, you know, pull it from publication or from your internal systems, make sure it isn't used again. Obviously, this is a slightly unusual case in that the photo was distributed by Kensington Palace on social media. So I think it's a bit harder to just tell people don't use it. But I think it shows that the agencies don't want to have been seen to have verified it when they realised that there are all these issues with it. And, you know, like, hearing some of them speak afterwards, like, they were like, literally, the problems with it are so obvious, actually. yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty serious. I mean, Phil Chetwynd on from AFP, sorry to mention it, but on the media show this week, he did the other one.
The other place, I think that's how you refer to it.
But it was very good, because he literally spoke about how the agencies had, like, met up on a Zoom call before doing this, which I didn't realise. So it wasn't like one of them went and then they all followed. Like, they did agree, yeah, you're right, that is dodgy, let's distance ourselves from that. And he also said that, like, it happens so rarely, this sort of kill notice, and it's usually from pictures issued from, like, the North Korean agency and Russia, you know, places that you wouldn't normally trust.
I mean, I guess, sort of as a layman with this, you sort of feel, but aren't all photos sort of touched up or changed? Like, what pushed this over the edge for them to sort of react in quite a dramatic fashion?
So there's a difference between, like, touching up slightly, like maybe the lighting or something, and changing the, like, truth of the story, like a photo. Like, if they think it casts any doubt on, you know, whether that scene actually happened, then
do you think that's their concern
issue?
That, you know, we've used Google's, like, pick the best smiles of all the children?
Well, I think the problem is that they just don't know, and they asked Kensington Palace for the unedited photo and they didn't provide it. So in that case, you just can't trust it. You can't go, well, it might be fine. You know, I think it's right for them to have a hard line on this, because their entire product is built on trust, both from the audiences that ultimately see their pictures and other content, and from the publishers that work with them. So I think if they take a strong position on this, then they would on every other piece of content as well. I think it's the precedent.
I mean, it's like a relatively minor story, but at the same time, like,
well, it fits into the whole eco drama of it all.
Yes,
it?
But I just was thinking, like that thing about editorial standards. Like, if it was a photo of, I don't know, a police officer at a protest with his fist raised, and you change the angle of the fist, that may well change the nature of the story. So they obviously have to draw a line somewhere and go, we're just not taking photos where you've messed around with where people's arms might be. Or,
I mean, Rebecca, it's interesting from a sort of consumer perspective. Yeah, as was said, it was published on the Instagram. They sort of sent it out to the public. Do they sort of understand that because it's come from them, it's likely to have been touched up and this doesn't really matter?
Oh, I think because there's been so much speculation, hasn't there? Because, you know, Kate has been sort of off work because she's been having operation and everyone's gone, well, where is she? Where is she? And you just think the one thing you need to do when you put a photo out is not have it obviously have been altered digitally in some way. Do you know what I mean? This is the one thing that probably would have shut up a lot of that speculation.
Yes, I mean, they have managed to complicate the story even more. You have the kind of the wedding ring scenario. How truthful is the picture? Mm. And then I thought it was interesting. I said on a call with some colleagues, I went, I bet you they get her out today. You know, the sort of proof of life type, she is fine shot. But then that was even sort of mucked up, really, because she was sort of looking the wrong way in the car. And everyone goes, oh, it's a plant. You know, it's not a real person, which is probably very much untrue. But they seem to continually mess this up.
Yeah, I think it's an absolute PR disaster. Yeah. Like,
it's not as if they're new to this.
No, I mean, yeah, they should have some of the best PRs in the country, frankly.
And I just, when I saw the story came up on BBC on my phone, and I just thought, oh, I'm going to have a look at this photo, see if I can spot it. I bet I won't be able to. Oh my God, okay, that sleeve looks really weird. It took like me just pinching out on my phone and going, oh, yeah, I can see that. And I'm not, you know, a picture person. I'm not a picture editor. I'm not a designer. And I'm going, I can kind of see what's wrong with that. You just think like there must be somebody else who can go, you want to put that photo out? Of course, Your Highness. Can I just take a look? What have you done to it? Yeah, no, I can see that's happened. Maybe not.
I mean, Charlotte, but some of the papers, they published the photo for early editions, didn't they? Or late editions. They didn't sort of spot anything. And then it was kind of everybody jumping on social media to then point it out.
I guess it's partly that thing of like Kensington Palace was, probably not is anymore, a trusted source to them. So they wouldn't feel the... Why would you? There's no precedent to be zooming in and checking those things. Like, unless you're thinking to look for it, as conspiracy theorists on the internet were the first, you know, like, yes, it started with them, but it was right. You know, why would they? And generally, you'd take photos like that from... like the palace and other reliable sources in good faith. But it does make the point that press photographers have been talking about this week of like just handout images being an issue. It's also an issue with like Downing Street. They have an official photographer for the Prime Minister, and sometimes they exclude like independent press photographers from being at like big moments, but then will hand out these pictures from number 10's photographer. And obviously there's just a level of trust with those photos that you don't have compared to press photographers, where you trust them because you know that there are certain procedures they would always do and not do.
Well, there's more on this story and the Royal PR operation, plus tabloid fakery, in the Two Mats podcast. Matt Kelly and Matt Dancone, if you want to get more of that, in the Two Mats. Okay, moving on to another soap opera, this time at The Telegraph. Will they, won't they, be bought by Redbird IMI? We've covered it on the show quite a bit. This is the UAE-backed consortium. Charlotte, what's the latest?
So, first...
I mean, it is a sorry, isn't it? It's like, what is it now?
I don't know if it was the last time I was on this podcast all the time before. I feel like I did a whole spiel about where it was at as well. But firstly this week, Bloomberg had a report saying that News UK and, again, back to Lord Rothermere's DMGT, were considering or in talks to kind of pitch in to Redbird IMI's deal, and that would result in reducing their stake, which might make the deal more palatable to the government scrutinizing it. It's not clear like how reliable that report is. Like, I think DMGT did say, well, you know, we're not in talks with them, or, you know, so I don't know, but it was a very interesting report.
Solution.
Yeah, you can see the logic. And obviously at News UK, it seems that they're most interested in the Spectator and that angle with it. But then, so midweek, I think Wednesday, in the Lords, where the Digital Markets Bill has been having its kind of third reading, Tina Stahl was bringing in an amendment that would kind of just stop foreign government ownership altogether. And then the government said, we are doing this. We are going to...
like staple it onto the
yeah,
bill,
so, yeah. Yeah, so it's, you know, it obviously doesn't like cite the Telegraph specifically, but it's about foreign state ownership. I think it's unclear whether it would stop even that minority stake or whether they can be involved at all, or whether they just can't have a majority stake. I think there are still a few question marks, but basically, I mean, it's a game changer.
It is. I mean, it really causes them trouble. And when I look at it, and you've got, you know, Russian owners of the Evening Standard, you've got Australian owners of the Sun and the Sunday Times. This has been designed to stop a single deal rather than think more about the true nature of media plurality in the UK. This is also Tories and their mates, isn't it? You know, this is the Telegraph's an important Tory title, and they've managed to get the government to do what they want.
Yeah, so I mean, it has been a very political issue, like, and you know why they've done it, but equally, you know, it is different to those ones you cite, and the FT's owned by a Japanese company as well, but it's different to them obviously because it's a foreign state, like an UAE royal and member of government that is kind of this is obviously isn't part of it, it's all foreign states, but the very fact that UAE have kind of press freedom concerns as well, it is different to all those other kind of foreign-owned companies in a very key way. I mean, you wouldn't even want the UK government to buy it, you know, would you? So kind of what's the difference?
They have said that Norwegian wealth funds, they're okay to do what they want. That was the most important thing.
Well, Norway's very lovely and
calm. Of course. Rebecca, I mean, obviously this is about newspaper groups, but Redbird are in for other acquisitions, aren't they? They've got their eye on All3Media.
They have indeed. So All3Media is one of the kind of super indie groups that owns a lot of production companies in the UK. And it is just going to be a massive deal if it goes through, absolutely. I suppose there's probably less concern because there is that issue about press freedom, which is slightly different to TV production, and there's kind of been slightly less noise about it. But yeah, it is interesting that they do seem to be kind of getting their fingers in a lot of media pies there.
No concern from the Prime Minister about UAE's interference in Midsummer Murders, though?
No, but I think that could be fun. Actually, that'd be really interesting.
Maybe take it in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
Just before we take a break, we saw this week that BBC News podcast chief Jonathan Aspinwall is to lead the New Look Newsnight team. Rebecca, their audio podcast Newscast is already televised. Do you think they might switch Newsnight the other way?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think it is really interesting that there has been this kind of move in podcasting towards kind of visual mediums as well. And also that, yes, sort of traditional audiences for visual mediums are like, oh, yes, I would like my same people on my podcast, on my phone, whenever I want, while I'm doing other things. So I think it's possible. And I think, you know, we were saying last time I was on the show that about kind of the winding down of the kind of investigative opportunities in sort of British media, and where podcasts are still kind of doing quite well at that. And that, you know, when all the jobs were cut at Newsnight, that a lot of it was the investigative reporting that was going, and they have been the last bastion of that for quite a while. That's quite not quite fair, not last bastion, but one of the sort of the few remaining
key place for it.
Yes, yeah. So if that's what kind of keeps it afloat, or keeps, you know, keeps that sort of going, then great.
I think Newsnight podcast is sort of almost a no-brainer.
Yeah.
You know, it's good quality political chat. Get it when you wake up. If you missed it in the night before, I think they can do more of those things.
Something that comes to my mind, though, is actually from my chat with Jamie East. Mm. So shout out again. But he said that he hates when people like make podcast video, and I guess this kind of goes the other way around, because when it's being filmed, which obviously Newsnight would presumably, if you did that, still be video first, you just naturally do things that you wouldn't if it's audio, and it like it just means it's not such a good audio experience. Like, for example, just, you know, gesturing at someone instead of saying their name, or like not explaining something because it comes up on a banner on the screen, or all those sorts of techniques. So I think you would have to think quite, you can't just transplant it. But I do agree with the principle that if it's like an interview and discussion thing, I mean, that's basically what a lot of podcasts are now.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I get that.
I'll tell you what, the YouTube commenters for the media podcast last week were not happy. If you want to go and see what they think, go and check us out on the YouTube channel. In fact, why not do this whilst listening to some brilliant ads, and we'll be back with some more media news.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the first riot of the Luddites.
Then on Tuesday, we unearth the mad coincidence of the day two different Dennis the Menaces made their comic strip debuts.
On Wednesday, the day the Spanish conquered the last Maya kingdom.
Thursday was the day Colonel Sanders sued KFC.
And on Friday, we recall how Vincent van Gogh's sister-in-law made his name.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome back. Charlotte and Rebecca here for some more news in brief. This week, the television trade body PACT issued a set of principles for TV companies working with AI. Rebecca, there's five in total. Can you name them or any of them?
Yeah, I cannot run them all off in a list, no, unfortunately. But so there's a lot of concern around copyright with AI, getting copyright right, and essentially that copyright needs to be fed. Oh, sorry, that AI needs to be fed material in order to learn. A lot of that is copyrighted. So often what it spits out is very close to what was the copyrighted material, and that is something that legally we're still wrestling with. There are also issues around diversity and around bias, that, you know, again, that material that's fed into AI, particularly with visual stuff, tends to be around, you know, tends to be often it can be, if you feed a lot of white faces in, it's not going to be very good at reproducing black faces or Asian faces. And they kind of, you end up with this kind of, this bias going on. Or, you know, if it takes material off the internet, which is quite racist, it probably will spit out racism or sexism or whatever.
And also some of the providers have got into trouble in the last couple of weeks by creating more diverse Nazis and those sorts of things, which is probably...
was the problem with the Nazi party, I guess.
very diverse. Other things they suggested, valuing human creativity, responsibility and accountability, as you said, D&I, minimising that bias, and also data privacy, kind of what's going in or where it's getting this information from. Charlotte, speaking of copyright and AI, we also saw Microsoft in court this week trying to convince a judge in a New York Times case. What are Microsoft trying to say?
So OpenAI are also trying to dismiss it. Obviously, it's against both of them. And they're basically saying New York Times is over-egging it. You know, the way that it's claiming that people would use ChatGPT and therefore reproducing their articles within it, that just isn't how people would use it. Microsoft brought up the fact that, like, Hollywood opposed the arrival of VCRs in like the 1970s and said it's like that and it doesn't matter, but
they're sort of building a new market and you can be annoyed at the moment, but there'll be something
exactly
more.
But there is the crucial flaw in that VCRs didn't steal the copyright.
They didn't generate their own movies, did they?
it feels to me like a crucial part that the analogy doesn't cover.
Rebecca, are TV companies excited about AI, worried about AI, or are they not getting into it yet?
Bit of both. Depends which bit of the market you look at. I think there are people. Obviously, part of the writers' strikes in America was this concern about AI. And, you know, while I think we're still a really long way off, you know, a TV show completely, you know, the next... Well, there's not going to be a next series of Succession, but, you know, the next Succession is not going to be written by a computer. But, you know, one of the things that a lot of these writers were expressing concern about was that, you know, there's kind of prep work and the sort of research and sort of, you know, drawing up synopses and things that they used to get paid for. And now increasingly they're sort of being asked, well, you know, could you just do that as a show of willing before we give you the job? And of course, if you've got a computer that can just do it for you, you've got AIs just do it for you, then... we don't need you. And that's a part of their income that has just gone. So there is that. There are parts of the industry that are embracing it. I think Springwatch has been using it for... Basically, if you've got like a camera aimed at a hole, a little vole or something, it's going to come out of. And using AI to be like, when did the vole come out of the hole? When did it do something interesting in the week we had a camera pointed at it? When did the baby come out? Rather than have some poor research assistant have to watch a week's worth of footage and identify when anything interesting happened, it can kind of... So, you know, going through... And so there is donkey work that can be taken out by AI, and I think that the industry is quite interested in, but it's where, again, it comes back to that point about human creativity and human work, that it's sort of, where is it taking... sort of jobs and possibilities and opportunities away from people and taking the opportunity for creativity away.
Yes, no, if that's a Springwatch example, it means they could look at 20 vole holes, right, couldn't they? And the one person that previously would have been able to look after a couple can manage the AIs to find all that information. And that doesn't necessarily save you any money, but enhances your program.
Yeah.
But they may not choose that option. They may choose the cash-saving option.
The sort of thing, I think the New York Times thing is interesting because there's a bit of me that thinks like, there are in every newsroom, particularly in like the 24-hour news cycle, there are news stories where you're like, this is just a press release that we're rewriting. And you sort of think, actually, if you could get AI to do a bunch of that and have a human read it at the end, obviously, for legal things and for accuracy, that will probably free up reporters to do more of this investigative shoe leather journalism that there isn't the capacity for. But at the same time, media owners aren't going to hear, oh, we've got the AI program that will rewrite the press releases. That means our three reporters can do more involved stories. It's going to mean, well, maybe we only need one reporter, which is, you know, the depressing thing, right?
I think it depends on the type of company. Like we were talking about before about like whether it's private or public and where you can invest. But, I mean, NewsQuest, to be fair, like the regional publisher are doing exactly that already. Like someone in the company came up with this AI tool and they're using it to do like the press release type stuff. And then... you know, when there's a big story like when that tree was cut down. They were able to send someone out like just to focus on that, and then kind of the stuff that had to just go in the paper could just be kind of done by AI and then checked at the end. But it meant that someone could actually be out of the office, and I think that is quite good. But the issue is that not all publishers would do that.
That's the thing. My editor did admit to feeding a news story into ChatGPT, and he went, do you know what, it actually came out not bad. And I was like, no, stop it, Chris, I have like one marketable skill, please don't replace me.
As someone who sends out press releases, there's a bit of me that's like, I wouldn't mind the AIs reading them, not to write them up, but just to flag up, this is a good one, there's something in this. That'd be really useful. Rather be at the mercy of people's inboxes.
Yes,
so someone can make that service, I'd be very happy. It continues to be a tough time for kids' TV this week. BBC Kids Chief Patricia Hidalgo saying that there was a growing need for third-party funders from overseas. What's she talking about, Rebecca?
So, I mean, this is a trend across a lot of TV more widely, and it is a particular issue for kids' TV, I think, in some ways. But essentially, back in the old days, if you ran a production company, you would go and pitch your show, I want to make this show, to, say, the BBC or Channel 4, to a commissioner at a channel, and the commissioner would say, yes, I like that, here's the money to make it, off you go. Now, where for various reasons most outlets have less money than they used to, and production is costing more and more as production inflation happens, basically the cost of everything goes up, it's just costing more and more. So now commissioners are saying, cool, here's 60% of the money, go find the other 40%. And the way they're doing that is by going out to the distributors that we're seeing at places like London TV Screenings. There's these companies that basically just buy into the production of the show. So previously, you'd have made your show, it would have been on the channel, and then at some point, you'd have had the rights internationally to go and sell to these distributors. Now the distributors are coming on at the beginning, or a broadcaster in another country, so maybe an Australian broadcaster will come on and give you the other half of the money. which means that you can make your show and the BBC gets to show it here and the Australian broadcaster gets to show it in Australia. And that's how it's working. But obviously that is just so much more work to do before you get your show made. And in kids' TV particularly, because they don't... I'm not an expert in kids' TV, but I was chatting to Faraz Osman, who's been on the podcast for a few times, who runs Goldwaller. And he was saying, like, actually, you know, they only made about 100 episodes of In the Night Garden.
Mm.
Because with kids, you can just show them the same thing again and again and again. So, like, actually, those rights, being able to sell off those rights afterwards used to be really important to producers. So they're kind of, because they're having to bring them in at source, or they're having to, yeah, sell them out to other broadcasters, it's just diminishing that sort of nest egg as
I think
well.
Someone's telling me that CBeebies, obviously it's really cool to try and get your show on CBeebies, great chance for success, may only fund 10 to 20% of a show. So the amount of work you have to do to kind of get that going, hoping you're going to flog some lunchboxes afterwards, let alone do everything else, is really important. So Charlotte, do you think they should hit up Redbird IMI for a bit of cash? is that the answer?
I mean, Redbird IMI did say in their response this week, like, well, we thought the UK media was a good place to invest, and clearly not. But so, yeah, maybe get them with some non-new stuff while it's hot.
Maybe that's the way to go. Right, just enough time for the media quiz. This week entitled Top of the Pods, Edison Research from America, they released their third quarter survey of British podcast listening. But can you guess where these popular pods land in the survey? It's a bit of fun. Other data sets are available. So buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Charlotte, you will say.
Charlotte.
And Rebecca, you will say.
Rebecca.
Let's play Top of the Pods. You can imagine the music. Rights issues. Question number one. In the top 25 podcasts in the UK, who's at number one for the third quarter running? Number one show for UK listeners, not presented by somebody from the UK.
It's not Charlotte.
Charlotte.
I forgot my name.
Is it Joe Rogan?
It is. The Joe Rogan Experience, sadly, is the number one podcast in the UK. Now the show's not exclusive to Spotify. I imagine it's probably going to go up even further in future quarters. People just love him.
Sure.
Some people do, yeah.
Okay, right, question number two. Which show is not only at number 16 in the Edison chart, but is also the only British show in the US equivalent as well?
Any more clues?
Well, traditionally famous. So this is a show called Shits and Gigs.
Oh, okay.
Best friends James and Fuhad chatting with Gen Z friends. So black show doing well UK and US. I think it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that there's certain things we're aware of and not aware of that doesn't kind of cut through, just does a really good job. Also shows that, Rebecca, that indie podcasts can still make it.
Yeah, because I think there did used to be a bit of a thing of, oh, you just have your podcast on and then, you know, you can run a business off it in a couple of years, and then that sort of got walked back. So yeah, I think that's really great there. And you know, like you say, they're unknowns, or they weren't famous before this, because I was going to say, like, The Rest Is Politics. Yeah. I was just like, maybe
two best friends,
maybe. Yeah, sort of. I don't know, that's the gimmick, but those shows that have the talent, the names, are the ones that seem to be doing well at the moment. Well, the conventional wisdom is that you need a name to do well. So I think that's amazing that it's sort of something that is kind of coming from a sort of grassroots level. That's brilliant.
Sure, commissioners are taking a look at that to see where they can be enjoyed on other platforms too. Okay, question number three. What is the highest rated BBC podcast in the chart?
Rebecca, is it Uncanny?
It is Uncanny. A bonus point for anybody if you can tell me what number it placed at. Take a guess.
Five?
Four?
Number 11. Uh-huh. So outside the top 10. Charlotte, should the BBC be worried they can't break the top 10 of this list?
Well, it's good for all the commercial, which you know, have spoken a lot about all the challenges the BBC posed to them. So maybe it kind of says, don't worry, the BBC, you know, it's not like the top 10's all BBC. You've still got plenty of space and people like your stuff, so it's reassuring.
Rebecca, could it be that BBC Sounds, kind of they leave some shows that are just there and it's harder for things to break out to everybody else?
It is a strange one, isn't it, BBC Sounds? Because I can sort of see why they're doing it, because you get all the data, you can, and because they have so much of a back catalogue of everything that's been on the radio as well that they can just use. But I do find there are some things where, like... The Friday Night Comedy podcast, I really like, but to get the latest one, you have to have it on BBC Sound.
Yes.
And I normally have sort of my normal podcast app. And then at some point I go, oh, wait, oh, that's probably on, isn't it? I'll go and have a look. But I have to remind myself to go and look for content there rather than just going on my normal app. So, yeah.
Does that mean it's worked or it hasn't worked?
I don't know, though, because there are probably times when I forget. Maybe I would listen more and they would have more downloads if it was just coming up in my regular podcast feed. So I don't know. I suspect probably that is partly what's doing it. But then you wonder, is that the sacrifice they're making to have that data? Because they must have loads of data about who's listening to what and what they can promote, and maybe that is just more valuable to them.
Yes, well, scores wise, it's one apiece, so a draw today. Both of you get to work together to try and get us into the top 25 for next time for the media podcast. Thanks to Rebecca and Charlotte for joining me today. Charlotte, how can people keep up with what you're doing?
Check out pressgazette.co.uk, and I'm still occasionally on Twitter/X at Charlotte Tobit.
Rebecca?
I'm at Rebecca K. Cooney on Twitter, X, at any name but Becky on Instagram, and I am, you can find my work on broadcastnow.co.uk.
Lovely. Thank you both.
Cheers.
That's it for today. Remember, there's 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we record our show every week. Just use the code MEDIAPOD when you head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off your first booking with the code MEDIAPOD. And if you're new to the show, make sure you follow us in your podcast app of choice or subscribe to us on YouTube and watch us in glorious Technicolor. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production, and I'll see you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.